All across America and around the world, this is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
And now, your host for today's program, Bob Gould.
Hey, and good day to you folks and everybody out there, all our listeners all across America, actually around the world. This is Bob Gould, Veterans Radio. We're bringing you another program live from our flagship station right here in beautiful Ann Arbor, Michigan. That's WAAM Talk Radio 1600. Talk Radio 1600. Anyway, we at Veterans Radio, we tell the stories of veterans and we give you little historical perspectives and we stay away from the politics, okay? Yeah, we'll leave that to the people in Washington and all over the world. We'll let them do that. But we like to tell the stories. Today I've got two gentlemen are going to be my guests. One is going to be coming from the Michigan Military and Space Museum. They're going to tell us all about that. If you got something to do in the wintertime, you know, when the skies are gray and snow's falling or not falling and all on the ground, you got to have somewhere to go. And the Michigan Military Space Museum is one. And by the way, folks, have your pencils ready. I got a lot of information for you veterans out there, okay? First thing on the list is we get a lot of requests for how do I get my separation discharge paper, my DD-214. Well, if you've lost yours or you want to get one for a dad or an uncle or whatever, here's what you do. The best method, go to www.archives.gov and follow the prompts. That's how easy. www.archives.gov, follow the prompts, and that'll help you get that DD-24. Be sure and have copies of all the material that you have. So anything that you do send to them, always have copies. And if you are a brother or a mom or whatever, please state that you are a relative and exactly what you are. Okay. All right. Well, that takes care of that. We got a couple other little things. Wednesday, February 14th. And this is the Stone, remember folks, have a piece of paper and a pencil handy. Stonecrest of Rochester Hills welcoming all veterans to a Valentine's Day breakfast. Okay? Free to all veterans and their families. For more information, call them at 248-656-1403. That's 248-656-1403. Wednesday, February 14th. It's a Valentine's Day breakfast. I think I'm going to try and make it out there, Rochester, Michigan. And it's free to all veterans and their families. Thursday, the next day, February 15th, the Desert Angels are hosting another of their ongoing packing parties for the troops serving overseas. So you're going to want to get a part of that. What do you do to get that information? And it's the Oakland Sportsman's Club, okay? Oakland Sportsman's Club. Google that. I'm sure you're going to find information on there. But it's going to be Thursday, February 15th, a packing party. And they're going to, and by the way, if you're going to be coming there, or they are have needs of things like Valentine cookies, coffee, hot chocolate, Girl Scout cookies, letters of encouragement, everything from wipes to food products to snacks like dried fruits, nuts, meats, tuna, gum, candy, even chocolate, new socks and more socks, toiletries. These are many items that the troops do not have access to. So it's an opportunity to serve our troops, folks, as they serve our country. You can make a difference. That's going to be Thursday, February 15th, the Desert Angels. That's going to have a packing party at the Oakland Sportsman's Club in Clarkston, Michigan. Oakland Sportsman's Club. Okay, that sounds like a great deal. Boy, I bet that'd be a lot of fun, you know? And you can send them little messages thinking of you. And I talk to guys that have been over there, and they love getting those things. Right. Thursday, February 22nd, a week later, is hosting a veterans job fair. All right, something for veterans. Why do you want to hire a vet? Because they show up and they do their job, and they don't complain. So you want to hire a vet. All you vet, you employers out there that are listening to this, you're going to want to think about hiring veterans. And all you veterans that are looking for work, you want to go to the Canton Community Foundation job fair at Madonna University. That's in Livonia. Madonna University, Livonia. That's Thursday, February the 22nd. 10 to 2, so it's only 4 hours. You're going to have to move fast to get through. Remember to have a resume and take business cards, whatever you got. You know, take that Thursday, February 22nd. Saturday, February 24th, the Fallen and Wounded Soldiers Fund is hosting its 13th annual, I'll get this, folks, 13th annual dinner dance auction at the MGM Grand in Detroit. That's Saturday, February 24th, Fallen and Wounded Soldiers Fund. 13th annual dinner dance auction at the MGM Grand. Boy, that should be a lot of fun. And you could also do a little bit of gambling while you're down there. So that'll be former House Representative Mike Rogers will be there. He'll be the noted speaker. So that's Saturday, February 24th, 2018. And that's at the MGM Grand. Starts at 4 o'clock. If you want more information, call 248-417-6984. Once again, that's 248-417-6984. Whew, boy, got through that stuff okay. Good. Well, moving right along. This is a place that, this museum that I've visited many times in Frankenmuth. I like going to Frankenmuth, Michigan. It's about 90 miles from Detroit, and they have wonderful chicken dinners, and they got a Frankenmuth brewery and all kinds of nice little shops and things. That's in Frankenmuth. But they also have the Military and Space Museum. And, well, here to talk to us and tell us all about that is John Auger. John, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Good evening, Bob, and good evening to your listening audience. How are you today?
Oh, I'm... yeah. Are you, did you get the snow up there that we got down here?
Not as much, but we've had it falling for about 3 days straight now up here. So it's accumulating. You know, we probably got about six, seven inches. Something like that.
Yeah, I think we can like double that. Well, we'll send some your way if you'd like a little bit.
Yeah. Our polar bear out in the vestibule.
John was born and raised in Bay City, Michigan. He graduated from Olivet College, and he has a BA in history and social anthropology. Ooh, we ought to be able to pull that together. Social anthropology. So we like that, folks. And you have a. He was working on a master's degree in historic preservation at EMU, that's Eastern Michigan University. So he's now been for the past few years, he's been with, how long you been with the Michigan Military Space Museum?
About 3.5 years total, Bob.
Okay, and also John served in the Army. Yeah. And what did you do in the Army?
Well, I was an Army mechanic. Worked on anything from Humvees on up to the big Hemets and things like that. If I stayed a little longer, I would have had to do tanks. I'd have had to go back to school.
Yeah, well, you were involved in World War II living history and proudly portray a Screaming Eagle. That was me. I was with the Screaming Eagles, 101st Airborne. Yeah, right. And I'd like to come. In fact, I'm going to come back up there, maybe even this week. Are you open every day?
We are open every day of the week, 7 days a week, 10 a.m. to 5 p.m.
10 a.m., 5 p.m., folks. Okay, yeah. This is the Frankenmuth Military and Space Museum. Now, you were a mechanic truck driver, and I think this is a good segue. I know in the last couple of programs we've talked about Holly Mago. She was a soldier from Michigan. She died on January 31st, 2004. It was quite a story, and she was a mechanic. She was only 19 years old. 19. Gosh, we send these kids out there. To defend our country. Whew, she was 19, and she was riding in a Humvee. She also was a mechanic, and she was a truck driver. And she was a brave little soldier, as her mother said. Tell us about that. Just a few points, John.
Yeah, well, Holly, everything that came up, she volunteered for. She was, in fact, the mission she was on when the IED exploded, that killed her. She was had volunteered for that. She didn't need to go. It's something that came up, and she decided that she was she'd raise her hand, and so she was driving right in that Humvee when that happened. Here at the museum, we have a along with about 144 others at any given time, we have a display of Holly here at the museum.
Don't you have her last letter or something like that, or a scarf or something?
Well, we have we actually have her dress uniform, her beret, the special goggles that she had to wear during the daytime over there in the desert, boots, combat uniform, her, in fact, we also have the watch and her notebook that she had on her when it happened, along with her story and the medals that she received for her time in service.
And it, folks, that's worth a trip going up just to see that. And mm-hmm. When I've been there, it's very somber and very, honorable, I think.
Well, our motto here is to honor, respect, and remember not only our Michigan veterans, which is what we have here at the museum. It's all Michigan men and women, but all of our veterans throughout our country and throughout history here at the museum.
And you have a special medal of Michigan Medal of Honor section. Tell us about that.
Yes, we do. We actually have 31 Michigan Medal of Honor recipients on display here at the museum. Out of 111 total Medal of Honor recipients from the state of Michigan in 155 years, there's been 111. Out of that, we have 31 of them ranging all the way from Civil War up through Vietnam. Michigan has not had a Medal of Honor recipient for action since Vietnam. We've had, in the past 2 years, two recipients, Colonel Charles Kettles and Jim McLuhan, who both received Medals of Honor 2016 and 17, respectively, that received them for actions almost 50 years ago in, during the Vietnam conflict.
During the air show out at the Ypsilanti Air Museum, the Ypsilanti Airport, I had the honor of having Charlie Kettles with me.
Mostly
throughout the. I saw him in the parking lot. He was standing there waiting for a ride, and I looked at him, and he had the Medal of Honor around his neck. Oh, was that? Mm-hmm. Was that something? And I said, I know who you are. And so we chummed together throughout the day, and it was really quite something to see the reaction of folks, especially the kids. And that's something you think, you know, if you want to go up there to the Michigan Military and Space Museum, do you want to take the family? Darn right you do, because the kids love that stuff. And what they did with Charles is they, instead of high fives and what's happening, man, nothing like that. They were very humbled. The kids were humbled when they met him. Tell us some more about what you folks have to offer there.
Well, what we have here is, kind of said earlier, we have, at any given day, we have about 145 of our Michigan veterans on display here, mostly from our foreign wars, Spanish-American War on through modern day War on Terror. We have eight galleries that we have, World War One, World War Two, Korea. Also in World War One, I kind of glanced over that quickly, we have a section on our Michigan polar bears. These guys fought for 9 months up in and around Archangel, Russia, in the Arctic Circle against Bolsheviks back in 1918 and 1919 during the Russian Civil War. On beyond that, I believe I mentioned Korea, then Vietnam, Desert Storm, Gulf War, War on Terror. And we also have 16 of the 17 Michigan-born astronauts on display here, along with some other early space pioneers from the state of Michigan. And some new display cabinets with some new space memorabilia that we've recently acquired here at the museum.
Do you happen to have a capsule?
I do not have a full size. I do have a 1/3 scale Gemini capsule, like the one that General James McDivitt from Michigan, along with Ed White II, were in when Ed White took his very took the very first spacewalk outside that capsule. And but
oh boy, that was a
very
walk.
Detailed. Like I said, it's 1/3 scale, so it does fit in the building. But so, but then I also have, along with my Medal of Honor gallery, I also have a cross gallery here for all of those Michigan men and women that have received either the Distinguished Service Cross, Navy Cross, or Air Force Cross, which are our second highest military award, second only to the Medal of Honor.
And you you have here, I'm looking, okay, you have 170 other personal, as I'm reading here.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry, over 700 personal stories. Tell us about
that. Right, we actually have, we're a little closer now with some more donations in the past few months. We are about 850 personal stories and displays that we rotate through our galleries. So you could come, you know, let's say tomorrow and come back even a couple weeks later, and there'll be some new stories out for you to read and look at and see. And it's all things that are donated by the veterans and or their families to us here at the museum to honor those folks.
Well, now, we've only got a minute or so. And
sure.
John, tell the folks out there, you kind of get the last word. Go ahead and tell the folks what would be in it for them if they come to the Michigan Military and Space Museum and bring the family, if they've got the family, like mom and granny and all the rest of them. Hmm? What do you tell us about that?
Well, I would tell them, yeah, definitely bring everybody. Even for the kids, we have a bingo scavenger hunt for them to do to go around as they're looking at all of these Michigan heroes, men and women, that some have given the ultimate sacrifice. Many of them, most of them made it home from their time in service. But all of these people here, as I walk around and look at them on the phone here, they are... It's just fantastic stories. It's personal stories. It's their items. You'll never see anything like this anywhere else. You go to a museum, it may say something like, oh, donated by, you know, Joe Smith. But here you get, yeah, this is Joe Smith's coat and hat and everything, but you also get to read the personal stories of each and every one of these great individuals that have helped shape our country and protect our freedoms throughout history.
And that's important, folks. It's just like Veterans Radio. You can read the stories, find out all about these folks and what they did. All right, this is the Michigan Military and Space Museum. If you want more information, it's Michigan's, there's an S, Michigan's, yep, Military Museum.com. Michigan's Military Museum.com. They're in Frankenmuth, Michigan. 989-652-8005. That's 989-652-8005. Thank you very much, John, for being on the program.
Well, thank you, Bob, and have a great evening.
Well, I'm going to be seeing you folks in the next week or two. I think I'll just make...
I hope to, yeah.
I want to have one of those wonderful chicken dinners. I really love those. Mm.
Okay. And we'll give you a great tour, too.
Okay. Thanks for being with us, John, and say hello to John Ryder, please.
I will. Thank you, Bob. Have a great evening.
Well, there we are, the Michigan Military and Space Museum, actually, is what it's called. Quite a nice thing. We'll be right back with you in a moment, folks, with Kevin Hemel. We're going to be talking about all of the action. What happened after Normandy? What did they break out? Did they get stagnant? Were they trapped? What was going on? We'll be right back right after this very brief message. Ah, we're back with you on Veterans Radio, and we got our second guest is Kevin Hemel. You've heard of Kevin Hemel, right? If you watch the History Channel, the American Heroes Channel, C-SPAN, Fox News, boy, and Book TV. He has author of Patton's Photographs and Patton, Legendary World War II Commander. Boy, we're going to find everything we want to find out about Patton some more. Kevin Hemel also is a historian for the U.S. Air Force Surgeon General at Lackland Air Force Base in San Antonio, Texas. Ooh, we'll have to. That's going to be my first question in just a second. He's also a historian, tour guide for Stephen Ambrose's historical tours, and gives World War II tours on D-Day. Good. And you can see all the parts there where Band of Brothers and George Patton's battlefields, etc. He's also research director for Sovereign Media, which publishes World War II history, World War II History Quarterly Magazine. Boy, are we going to get all the right information, Welcome. Give a big welcome to Kevin Hebel. Kevin?
Hey, Bob. Thanks for not playing me up too much. How you doing, man?
Hey, I'm doing okay, big guy. I don't know, it's about the 10th time you've been on, and we always get lots of calls and emails about your guest appearances here. This, I mean, you really do know all about this historical information. So, what was that I was going to? Oh, yeah. What is a historian doing for the U.S. Air Force Surgeon General? What is that all about?
Well, just about every branch of the military and every service within it has to submit a yearly history. And so they need historians to write what the different services are up to. So the Surgeon General wants a report on everything that the Air Force Medical Service has done in the previous year. So I and my colleagues, gather up information, interview people, and write up about, 100-page report on that. But because we have such a large office and some really good researchers, we also do separate projects, small histories of different things that the Air Force Medical Service has done, like body armor in World War II. That was the medical service came up with that. Scientific experiments about high altitude pressure on people's bodies. So it's an interesting cross between medicine and military, and making pilots safe and airmen safe.
And how big of a department is that, this history department for the Surgeon General? Is it you or is it you and a staff?
No, Judy Taylor is my boss, and then there is an archivist, two historians, and a multimedia specialist who does great artwork. So we're just a small team there churning out histories for the U.S. Air Force Medical Service.
Where do you get most of your information?
We have our own archive and we have our own archivist, and so we rely on that a great deal. Or sometimes we'll simply call a department. We have a very good deputy who kind of disperses that the requests to us, and always helps me with research, because I'm a little new to the Air Force. I'm an Army, kind of an Army guy. But it's very interesting work, and it's a little different all the time. You know, we'll have a hospital contact us and say, hey, is there any historical incidents where we had to, create a whole bunch of beds in a hospital rapidly? And I looked into it and said, yes, the Korean War. And so I wrote up a small essay about how the Air Force increased bed space during the Korean War, because we weren't really expecting that war. So little projects like that I really enjoy working on.
We got just before the break here. How did they increase bed space?
Well, something that you can't really rely on today was a three-part idea that they fixed up the hospitals they had. They built a few more, but they also relied on hollowed-out hospitals, temporary hospitals that we built during World War II. So we were able to go in and refurbish old temporary buildings that were used as hospitals in World War II, because they're only about, 5 or 6 years old, and that helped with that influx of casualties from Korea.
Well, is there somewhere that my listeners can go and get more information? Is there a website?
No, well, not really, but I tell you what, if I do find out, well, I'll mention it on the next show, because these requests come in from commanders at different Air Force hospitals, and we're directly answering them.
Yeah, I would think so. That would be really cool. Yeah, we'd like to pass that along. And what do you see in the future for the Surgeon General? In the historical.
I see in the future. Well, we're getting a new Surgeon General. The General Edgar, who's in charge right now, he's being turned over. He's been in there for, I think, about 4 years. So we're expecting some turnover, and the The new Surgeon General is a nurse, and she will be wearing the three stars of Surgeon General of the Air Force. So it'll be interesting to see how we transition from having a doctor as the leader to a nurse. So I can't really predict the changes, but I know there will be some changes. So it'll be an interesting time to be on board.
And you're, that's nice to hear. And you're going to be, and you're going to be doing as a historian with this group. You're still going to be with them, correct?
Yes.
Okay. Do you have a website, Kevin?
I do not. This is my website, hanging out with you.
Oh, I like that. Dale, too, right? We got it. I wish Dale were here, but he's, I don't know what he's doing today. Probably having a good time with, well, whatever. Okay, Kevin, we're going to be right back. We're going to be talking about next, the breakout from Normandy and the Brittany Coast. What the heck is going on? The band is standing up. We got the news coming up. Kevin, have yourself a cup of coffee or glass of water or what. You're listening to Veterans Radio. You'll be right back. Don't go away. Talk Radio 1600. We're back here on Veterans Radio. We'll tell the band to take a break now. Go ahead, guys and gal. So we're back here on Veterans Radio and Talk Radio 1600 in beautiful Ann Arbor, Michigan. It's our flagship station. We're also, and you might want to go to www.veteransradio.net. That's right, not .com, .net. That's veteransradio.net. I'm speaking with Kevin Hemel, a historian that's going to be telling us all about the U.S. Army and Normandy and the breakout. Well, okay, let me give you a little bit of background. Of course, we all know in the euphoria of D-Day and Overlord and the movie Private Ryan, and we're looking, and there they are. They've solved everything, and the Army is moving on and going in. But that didn't happen. Not quite that way. They got stalled. They stalled. I didn't know that they stalled, and here comes the end of June and end of July. They only made 17 miles at one point, and here was all this material being built up. Bradley's got all this material. And one of the things I want to ask Kevin is, how do they get the tanks? I mean, gosh, they had to have a lot of tanks. They were going to use tanks. But before we get started on this, here was the Americans and the Allies. They're stuck, and there was Montgomery. He was stuck. Tell us all about that, Kevin.
Sure. Well, the real plan was to establish that beachhead in Normandy, and Eisenhower did develop some phase lines about taking the rest of France, but the Army had really trained for nothing but getting off those beaches. And so when they encounter the rough terrain, they encounter what are called hedgerows. Now, these are old, I guess you could almost say, kind of partial brick walls that they would plant trees on back in like the 1600s and 1700s and just built up. So it's almost like a hill and a line of trees dividing each small farm. It's like a checkerboard, and it's a perfect defense for the Germans. Now, the British had hedgerows, but they were much lower, so it was quite a shock to the Americans to come and realize that, you know, you couldn't even look over these things. They were so heavily covered in trees and bushes. And it just becomes a grind where you're fighting for a couple of yards, a day or even a week, because the Germans could just retreat next to the next, you know, back one and keep the defense. And if you used a tank to go over them, the Germans would simply shoot at the bottom of the tanks as they came up, because that's the thinnest part of the armor on a tank. And it takes a while to develop the tactics and the strategy. And eventually kind of the real solution was just this slow grind. They eventually do develop what are called rhino tanks, putting prongs on the front of tanks to plow through the hedgerow. And that doesn't even work too well, because the Germans simply blast the tank when it comes through. It's when they do it with multiple tanks crashing through at several locations on a hedgerow that the Germans are overwhelmed. But by the time they outfit enough tanks for this, we're almost through the hedgerow country. It sinks the morale of the U.S. Army. It is a slow, bloody grind for both the Americans and the British. And the real, you know, the end of the rainbow kind of gold pot is, how do we break out of here? Because we're never going to win this war. We're going to lose too many men. you know, in this grinding fashion. And so Omar Bradley starts planning something called Operation Cobra, where they're going to use bombers, strategic bombers above the clouds, and they're going to try to use them in a tactical way to blast a hole through the German line. When they finally do it, the bombers, Omar Bradley thought they were going to fly parallel to the American line and drop them on the German lines, while the U.S. Army Air Forces actually fly perpendicular to the dividing line, a road west of Saint-Lô, and they start dropping the bombs. And, of course, the bombs explode and obscure the ground below, and the follow-up bombers can't see what they're dropping their bombs on, and they end up dropping on the American line and kill a large handful of Americans. And so it takes a little while for both sides to kind of shake their heads and get, you know, figure out what they're doing. No. And the Americans send infantry, you know, to attack the Germans, and the Germans are able to hold them off. But it's kind of a hollow shell defense. And it's really Troy Middleton, one of the corps commanders, says, okay, enough of this. I'm an infantryman, but I'm going to take the 4th Armored Division under Jack Wood and Groves 6th Armored, and I'm going to put them in the front and see what they can do. And these two armored divisions just kind of blast through the hole. They get a little held up with minefields at the beginning, but they start measuring their success in miles in a simple day instead of yards over a week. I mean, it really changes the whole atmosphere of the war in France that our armies are moving. And General Patton hasn't had a role in this yet. He is going to take command of his 3rd Army at the first day of August, but for about 5 days there, it's really Troy Middleton who puts the armor in front. And it just makes a huge difference. The 4th Armored Division takes a town called Coutant that the 6th Armored Division was supposed to take. In fact, no, the 3rd Armored Division was supposed to take it. And they start firing on each other. And the 4th Armored says, you know, we don't know that you're Americans. And they said, stop firing at us or we're telling P. Wood. And so the 4th Armored guy said, oh, my God, they know our commander. They are Americans. So they stopped shooting at each other. And Wood did such a good job of taking this objective that they give him a town called Avranche. And that's the real key, because once you blast through Avranche, France is kind of like an elbow right there. And once he can get to Avranche, he can turn west and go out into the Brittany Peninsula and start clearing out ports for the army. Or he can turn east and start attacking the Germans. So all these opportunities can open up with Avranche.
Okay. But I want to go back to this bombing business and this air. One of the questions I always had, and I'm looking at the movie Private Ryan. I mean, here they're attacking a pillbox, an impenetrable pillbox, and it's bad news. And the only way to do it was to take the men and get up there. But I often wondered why there wasn't, and I'm not talking about bombers, I'm talking about fighters. Heck, we were only 30-some miles from England, across the English Channel. They could have been there in a flash, get those thunderbolts. And why they weren't, how do I want to say, collaborated, they weren't communicated with, so that, I mean, here they could have gone in. And the same thing for when we were breaking out with having the fighters. Why wasn't that, Kevin? Why wasn't that possible to use fighters more during D-Day or during the breakout? Tell us about that.
It makes me shake my head every time I think about it, because in North Africa and Sicily, it's like we had to learn the lesson over again. You know that the system is not working. And so the infantrymen on the ground would radio back saying, we got a tank coming in, we got, you know, the enemy's in front of us, and they would radio it back to their headquarters. That headquarters would communicate it to the Air Forces. The Air Forces would communicate it to the pilots. So on average, when you saw the enemy and you needed a plane, it took from 60 to 80 minutes to get a plane. That's how long it took.
But who was responsible for the this bombing thing? And by the way, folks, they killed a lot of people. They killed a lot of allies. They missed their target, and they were. I mean, who put that whole plan together? Was that Bomber Harris from England, or who was that?
No, this really would have been Pete Quesada. He's the commander of fighter planes. But it's not until D-Day that he really starts getting experience. Now, to his credit, it took a little while, but they finally came up with an idea that not only worked, but you can almost say won the war. Now, you know, the fighting in Normandy is under Omar Bradley initially. He'd got First Army. And he meets with Pete Quesada right around the same time Patton's army comes active on August 1st. And they decide on this crazy idea of taking fighter pilots and putting them in tanks with air radios. And so because they figure fighter pilots speak the same language, you know, an army guy wouldn't be able to describe what's in front of him the way a pilot thinks.
I like it.
And so they try this experiment. Omar Bradley gives him two tanks. He says, put your radios and your pilots in there and have them drive with the troops. And it changes the face of warfare.
I like
it. You know, they're able to, you go from 60 minutes to get a fighter plane in to 60 seconds. I mean, it changes everything. And that's really how the breakout occurs. And when the Germans counterattack, Patton tells his own air commander, he said, you are going to guard my flank. Your planes are going to guard my flank. Had never been done before. And they stopped every German counterattack that the Germans could throw against them.
I like that. Boy, that was a great idea. Finally, well, you know, we didn't know anything about this, all the things that I've studied on World War II and all this fighter support that.
Yep.
That was missing, but I like that idea. I'm sure the pilots or the Air Force people weren't too happy about riding in one of those M4.
No, they hated it.
Sure.
They really did hate it. It was a demotion, but it was on a rotation. So you put your time in on the ground, and then you got back into your plane after a week or two. But the GIs on the ground loved it. I've talked to a lot of guys that said that, you know, they'd call that plane in, and it would go to a roadblock in front of them and blow it up. And then the plane would do a loop and come back and waggle its wings, and the men would be jumping up and down on top of the tanks. And on the ground, just cheering those airplanes when they would do things like that.
Oh, I like that. And have you given any of this information out in all those television programs you are? I mean, who knew this stuff?
When anybody asks me, I tell them. But yeah, I don't usually get that question, so I'm glad you asked me that.
Okay, well, part of the problem with the breakout was that the city of Caen was not in Allied hands. It was up to the British, and that was General Montgomery. And you know, folks, what I feel about General Montgomery, although one of our other historians, John McManus, gave high grades to Montgomery. And, well, anyway, he was the only one. However, I want to make a comparison between Patton and Montgomery, and I'm going to start with this. Here is a Patton quote, okay? It is foolish and wrong to mourn the men who died. Rather, we should thank God that such men lived. General George Patton, tell us about him.
Oh, sure. Very flamboyant. You always knew if you were under his command. Consummate professional. Spent all of his free time reading military history, was always trying to come up with solutions to problems, and knew that it took a dynamic leader and a real personality to lead men in combat, because it wasn't about the weapons. It wasn't about the equipment. It was about someone you could look to as a leader and follow. He understood that that was an important element in fighting wars. And he was considered a tank expert. He commanded tanks in World War I. Surprisingly, in Europe, in North Africa, and Sicily, he never commanded tanks. He always commanded corps or armies, which tanks were a part of. But he really sort of saw the solution that tanks could bring to the battlefield and pushed those ideas at all times. And so just a man who understood inspiration, understood how to fight a modern war. And I would say we were probably lucky to have him when we did in American history.
And was that the key to his battlefield genius? Was the fact that, well, tell us, what would be his battlefield, the key for his battlefield genius?
I think it was just the constant study of what was going on in front of him, what was going on historically. You know, he was able to figure out what bridges to cross in the Normandy area because he had studied Norman history while he was in England, and he figured out, well, you know, the oldest bridges, they're made of stone. They probably can resist bombing. So I'm going to plan on my guy crossing those old bridges that date back to the 1600s. Now, this is while he's in England. He takes out a map and figures this all out so that when he does finally get to France and start racing forward, he knows where to cross rivers because he knows those old bridges would withstand Germans trying to blow them up. So it's that constant 24-hour study of history, of weapons, of tactics that kind of, you know, rises him above a lot of his compatriots.
Now, so what did he think about Kahn? What was his point? I mean, what was he? Montgomery
well,
stuck.
I'll tell you about Kahn, and I'm glad you mentioned John McManus's name because I just think John's a stellar historian. And every time I disagree with John, we argue and I end up agreeing with him. So, you know, the real thing about Kahn is Montgomery had a big meeting of all the Allied commanders in St. Paul's. It was a school that he actually attended. And Winston Churchill attended this meeting, and he goes over the large plan of the Normandy invasion. And he claimed that meeting that he was going to take Kahn on D-Day. And, you know, a lot of Americans held him to that. But when he got back to his headquarters and went back to planning, they realized that there was pretty much a lot of German armor in that area and that it would not be possible. And so he kind of changed his plans based on that. But that was the last image he left with the Americans, that he was going to take Kahn on D-Day. And he ends up hung out, you know, stalled in front of Kahn, you know, for about a month and a half, if not longer, trying to take it. And so while the Americans are struggling in hedgerows, so are the British. And if they're not in hedgerows, they're in open fields where the Germans have the whole field covered. And he tries to sort of, you know, do the equal of Cobra, you know, with the bombers. He calls his Goodwood, and he misses just a lot of German anti-aircraft guns that they're going to turn and fire against tanks and other vital German places. The bombing was just ineffective. And it wasn't for a lack of effort. You know, on the German side, they were more concerned with the British Army, because they knew the British Army. The British Army had fought them for a very long time. They thought Americans were a bunch of cowboys who didn't understand warfare and teamwork. And so they really kind of sent their best troops against the British initially. And so it was sort of a no-win situation for the British. They're really facing Tiger tanks. The Americans are not. They're facing SS troops, where we're facing regular German army troops. So he really had a lot stacked against him, and it's a brutal fight. And a lot of times I think that the battle, the whole campaign, kind of looks like the campaign in Sicily if you flip the map upside down, because the British got stalled in Sicily. Patton met less resistance, but he does face resistance. But he breaks out and kind of circles around Sicily and takes two-thirds of the island, where Montgomery takes one-third. And it's kind of the same in Normandy. He is struggling and pushing down to Kahn while we push west, clear out the Cherbourg Peninsula. We push south, and we clear a whole path, and we come to meet him just south of Kahn. You know, I don't want to criticize him too much. He was really facing the bulk of the German army. But it really was Bradley and then Patton that do this freewheeling armored attack. They catch the German off guard, and they kind of turn the German corner with low casualties. The Germans don't see this coming, and Patton circles around the German 7th Army, and they finally close the fillet, what's called the fillet pocket, at a little town called Chambois.
And what happened there that they, something happened that let the Germans escape. What was that?
Well, it was that we were just simply slow on closing the jaws of the fillet pocket. And you could put a lot of the blame on that for Omar Bradley. The Germans, I think about 50,000 escaped. Patton basically had it in his sights that he was going to close this pocket. And what happened was Bradley commands First Army, right? And then when Third Army becomes active, Omar Bradley gets promoted to Army Group Commander. So he commands First and Third Armies. And the commander of the First Army is now a guy named Courtney Hodges. But when Patton swings around like that, he basically takes Hodges out of a job. I mean, he's pinched out of the battlefield. So Omar Bradley, as Patton's about to close this, says, George, stop. We're going to put Hodges in charge of this, you know, lower jaw. You keep heading east, and we'll let him take it. So they delay because of change of command. They have to develop a new attack plan. All this stuff Patton has figured out. Bradley, you know, kind of reinvents the wheel and delays the closing, you know, for about at least 4 days or 5 days, I would say. Meanwhile, the Germans are streaming east. Any wounded or and some dead, they've got them laid on the tops of the tanks trying to get them out of there. The Germans say they've never seen any kind of fire like this. Some of the troops are so exhausted they just collapse as they're trying to escape out of this narrow corridor that's almost like a tube of toothpaste being squeezed. And like I said, the Germans get about 50,000 troops out of there, which is actually kind of close to the number of Germans that attack in the Battle of the Bulge.
And could this have resulted, this stalemate, could this have resulted in a, quote, stalemate to where we would have had to sue for peace? Is that something that would have been possible had we not been able to break out?
No, I think, you know, we had so much equipment back in England that I think once the weight of it got over to Normandy, something had to give somewhere. We were just hammering away at the Germans on the Normandy coast as our troops were building up and building up. So I think it would have been an eventuality. Now, there was some talk. The British were getting a little bit skittish because, remember, Hitler starts throwing V1 rockets and eventually V2 rockets at London, and they have very little defenses against this. And you know, and that's why they give the bulk of some of the missions to Montgomery to go knock out those attack launch pads. In fact, there was a V1 launch pad in Cherbourg that Bradley's troops eventually take. But that kind of chilled the bones of the British that the Germans now had this weapon that they really did not have a good defense against. I think that was the only time there was a little bit of, oh my God, how is this going to end? But, you know, we mass our armies on that Normandy coast. They break through and they, and the real solution to those V weapons was knocking out their launching stations.
Absolutely. That was, you can't shoot them down in the air, so you're going to have to get the launching station. By the way, the V-1 and V-2 rockets had 1 ton of explosive. That's a lot, folks. That's a ton of explosives there as a warhead. Okay, well, we're moving along here. Oh, I know what I wanted to ask. On Bradley.
Yes.
Now, there's a couple. I want your, you know, give us your honest approach about, I mean, he's an icon, he's grandfatherly and what, but it sounds to me like he had a problem. He had a problem with understanding the complexity of Falaise and also the Battle of the Bulge. I remember that he wasn't convinced that there was going to be this big thrust. Tell us about that.
Sure. Well, I hate to say this, but I'm not a huge fan of Omar Bradley. I think he did do a competent job in Normandy. He let a lot of opportunities slip through his hands, and I rarely read a situation where he said, let's turn this around and try a different approach. You know, it usually came from some superior. They'd say, let's try a different approach, and he'd say, yeah, that's a great idea, boss. Let's do that. You know, I never really saw it coming from him. And, you know, I think he was at times wary of General Patton for good reason. Patton could be a big, big loud mouth, but he was, well, you know, Patton was always churning up the ideas. And, you know, when he showed him the invasion of Normandy and the Cobra plan, Patton would give him everything he had, you know, all of his ideas. And they'd say, man, Bradley took everything I told him and ran with it and didn't give me any credit. So he came to kind of resent that. But, you know, with the invasion of Normandy D-Day, you know, Patton said, geez, landing in daylight is a terrible idea. They're going to see us coming. You can't surprise anybody with a seaborne invasion. There's no flanking. They're going to see you. And he just, to almost the last day, kept saying, man, you really should make this a night attack. Because that's what Patton did. He had a night attack in North Africa. He had night attacks in Sicily, amphibious night attacks. And it kept casualties down. You know, you get to the filet pocket where you're trying to close these jaws. And Bradley is more worried that the Germans are going to break through his closing jaws, so he just doesn't do it. You know, and I think he had a term about it. He said, better, you know, what was it? Better a sore jaw in filet than a broken neck in Paris or something. He had some kind of saying. But, you know, Patton was always willing to take those kinds of risks. He would always factor in the enemy's fear. You know, if you get into the enemy's rear, he's going to get worried, and he's going to stop looking at his front because he's going to worry what's behind him. And that really kept Patton, you know, kept the enemy on his heels and rolling back. And Patton would just hammer away. He did it in North Africa, did it in Sicily, and he starts doing it in France. And Omar Bradley is the one I keep seeing kind of getting those cold feet going, whoa, whoa, whoa. You know, I don't think there's anything wrong with this, but we should slow down just for the sake of slowing down. You know, and that's going to, when you get to the Battle of the Bulge, you know, even Bradley's intelligence guy says, you know, I think there's an attack coming, and they kind of send him off for vacation. And it was, but I have trouble blaming him for the Battle of the Bulge, because I think when you're not expecting, when you think you got everything going your way, and the enemy surprises you, you just can't believe that he couldn't believe the Germans so knocked out as they were that, you know, it just defied logic to go on a huge offensive campaign. Much like with Pearl Harbor, people just couldn't even fathom that the enemy could do that, or even 9/11. You know, it's like, what? What did they do? How could this have happened? Because you're psychologically not prepared for it.
Yes.
Whereas, you know, during the Battle of the Bulge, Patton was monitoring not only his line, but First Army's line. And he said, boy, you know, I got an itchy feeling the Germans are going to attack. You know what? If they do, I could do this, 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 and this, if they do. And certainly when the Germans attacked, Patton put his plan into action and, you know, relieved Bastogne and helped close the bulge pocket. So, but I digress. We've gotten away from Cobra. I apologize.
No. We're all jumping around here, but these are things that I want to get answered. Well, what do we got? My screener says 3 minutes. We got 3 minutes. I got two things I want to cover. Number one, well, General Patton, he used flowering language. Is that right?
I wouldn't call it flowering language.
Colorful.
I would say lots of cuss words and, you know, very vulgar language. And his philosophy was when you put it to them like that, they remember it. And some troops really liked it, and other guys thought it was a little out of hand. But, you know, I always say that Patton had his style of leadership. It's not the style, it's his. You know, there is no perfect leadership style. Everybody has their own. I've followed people like Patton. I've followed people who are very mild but inspiring. You know, Dick Winters, you could say that. He rarely, used curse words, and he was a very quiet person, but he did the job, and people respected that. But that was very much an element of Patton. He believed in incredibly sharp discipline and speaking with a salty tongue.
And, well, we've got 2 minutes. I want to cover this one because you were bringing up Patton as the leader, Patton as the commander. He had one, and it was in the movie where somebody was, given away, it was General Groh, was looking for a place to cross. He's looking at the maps, and Patton said in so many words, this is going to happen. If not, I'm going to get somebody to replace you. We got 2 minutes. Go ahead and tell us about that.
So real quick, in the movie, in Sicily, he comes across a tank commander and says, why haven't you crossed this river yet? And Patton's on the other side of it. And he says, looking for a place to ford. He goes, well, I've already done it. So that was sort of a parody of what happens on the way to Couthon. Patton comes across Groh, and he's with one of his combat commanders, and they're standing in front of a river. And Patton says, you know, he's looking at the situation, and he says, you know, what are you doing right now? And Groh thinks he's asking him, like, are you free? Because I want to do something. So he says, oh, nothing, General. And that was the wrong answer. Patton goes ballistic and threatens to sack his corps commanders. He kind of goes, walks into the river. It's knee-deep. And he's like, why aren't you crossing right here? And so they immediately start pushing tanks across after Patton did that. And Patton could even see Germans on the hill in the distance. Now, in Groh's defense, I did talk to Groh's assistant a couple months ago, and he said what Patton didn't understand was that was a tidewater area, and the tide would come up very rapidly, and that's why Groh was planning on a bridge. But you got to give it to Patton. He went and walked into the water and didn't walk on the water. He walked into the water and got the tanks moving. So,
okay. Kevin, we want to thank you very much for being on the program, and come back and visit us again. Bob Gould, Veterans Radio, you're dismissed.